From the National Urban League, this is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses persistent policy, social, and civil rights issues affecting communities of color. I'm Clint Odom, Senior Vice President of Policy and Executive Director of the Washington Bureau.
And I'm Toni Wiley, Director of Advocacy for the National Urban League. In today's episode, we are talking about a topic that is near and dear to my heart and my head, and that is black hair. We are joined by two ladies, Ms. Kelly Joy Richardson Lawson and Ms. Orlena Blanchard. They are the Chief Executive Officer and Chief Operating Officer, respectively, of a black woman-owned marketing firm here in D.C. called the Joy Collective. They do some really powerful work to uplift the voices and experiences of black communities and really black women in particular. They are doing some amazing work to get the word out and to get legislation passed on hair discrimination, and that's in the form of a bill as the Crown Act. They are here today to share with us some information about the Crown Act and what it means to be discriminated against based on one's hair type or hairstyle that is racially based. It's so interesting that we're talking about this. We've seen so many issues in the media about black hair and what is acceptable and what isn't. Even amongst black people, there's controversy about what is acceptable with black hair. Black hair has risen to the point that we have to have laws to legislate how people are treated for hair that naturally grows out of their head and styles that are associated with their heritage and culture.
So for me, this was a great education. I'd been through Twitter kind of following some of these cases. And we know the popular cases about the young boy whose locks were forced to be cut during, an athletic competition. We've heard other stories of women who've been denied jobs or promotions because of their hair. I mean, this stuff really goes back, you know, to the early days of us being on this continent. Right. You know, do we want our hair to look like European hairstyles, or do we want it to look natural? And this issue has waxed and waned over the years, you know, with political movements. Mm-hmm. Hair is always a part of political movements, both revolting against and in support of things. Mm-hmm. So I think these ladies are going to give us really good perspective on hair discrimination. They're going to tell us what it is, mm-hmm. give us examples of it, mm-hmm. and tell us how any listener can get involved in making a difference to end hair discrimination. I'm very excited about the show.
I am too. I was trying to think about any kind of personal experience I've had with hair discrimination, and I think I've been very fortunate. If anyone knows me, I change my hair out quite a bit. I'm sure Clint has noticed that maybe.
I don't always say it, but I do always notice.
Okay, well, yeah. You know, thank you for noticing mm-hmm. and not saying anything, whatever that means. But And it is a part of my expression of my culture and my heritage, and I'm very proud to be able to wear my hair that way. And I think, like I've said before, I've been fortunate that that hasn't been an issue for me, and I haven't felt, even when I was in college at a predominantly white institution, I haven't felt that my hair in any way kept me away from opportunities. I used to wear Bantu knots in college, and I wore my hair straight. I wore my hair however I could afford to wear it in college. People always complimented me, or they noticed it and they said, wow, that's great. I'm glad you can have such versatility with your hair. It's always complimentary. So it's really disarming to me to know that people are being placed out of contention for jobs, housing, being discriminated against and bullied in school about their hair. And it's not just young women. It's young men, too, as you said, with the example about the young man whose locks were cut off during a wrestling match. It's an issue for all of our community, not just women.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, my own personal struggles with hair. You know, I started, you know, with a 4-head and then ended up with a 5-head. Mm. So, you know, the struggle is real.
Well, in some cultures, a prominent forehead is a sign of beauty. And a lot of top models have very prominent foreheads. So I think it's a really interesting topic. I'm very happy that the National Urban League was one of the original partners in the Crown Coalition, which is organizations who are committed to social justice and also have a close connection with the community. I would love for other members of the movement to learn more about the Crown Act, which these ladies are going to share with us a lot of information and how you can also get involved with getting legislation passed in your state. We already have legislation active in California and New York, I believe. They are working to get legislation passed in New Jersey. So if you're in those areas, please make sure that you get involved with this fight. This is something that the Urban League sees and we hear and we want to support.
I think wherever you see a critical mass of Black women, states and communities, you'll see this legislation following very soon.
Very good.
So let's get to it.
All right. But before we begin, let's hear a message from Mark Morial, President and CEO of the National Urban League.
I'm Mark Morial, and this is your To Be Equal moment. The facts on gun safety are clear. In fact, they are crystal clear. Since 1994, background checks have blocked over 3.5 million gun sales to felons, domestic abusers, and other people who aren't allowed to have guns under existing law. 90% of Americans support background checks for all firearm sales. That's 90%. Republicans, Democrats, Independents, the non-aligned, liberals, moderates, and conservatives. In every category, Blacks, whites, Hispanics, Asians, and Native Americans, Native Hawaiians, all support background checks for firearm sales. But Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, refuses to allow the Senate to vote on bills that have been passed by the House of Representatives and that would expand and improve background checks. Shame on you, Mitch. A ban on military-style assault weapons, in effect from September 94 to 2004, listen to this carefully, was associated with a 25% drop in gun massacres and a 40% drop in fatalities. Bans on military assault weapons save the lives of Americans. And guess what? 2/3 of Americans support a ban on military-style assault weapons. Should I say that again? 66.2%. That's right. 2/3 of all Americans support a ban on military-style assault weapons. But a bill to restrict the sale of military-style assault weapons remains mired in the opaque muck of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Now, one of the people who should have failed a background check to buy a handgun was Dylan Roof of Columbia, South Carolina. Because the check was not completed within 3 days, he was able to buy a gun. Stated differently, because of a loophole in the background check law, Dylan Roof got a gun, walked in, and shot and killed 9 people at the Mother Emanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. One of the people who was prevented from buying a gun because he failed a background check in 2014 was Seth Attor of Odessa, Texas. He had been committed to a psychiatric institution in 2006 because he was deemed a danger to himself and others. Because of a loophole in the law, a loophole that would be closed by the House-passed Bipartisan Background Checks Act, he was able to purchase an AR-15-style rifle through a private sale. He used that rifle to shoot nearly 30 people in Odessa and Midland, Texas, over Labor Day weekend, killing 7 and wounding 22. There were 6 other mass shootings in the United States that Saturday, leaving 5 more dead and another 20 injured. There have been nearly 300 mass shootings in 2019. That's more than one per day. There have been more than 10,000 deaths and more than 20,000 injuries from gun violence this year. And that's not even including suicides by firearms, which claim more than 20,000 lives each year. Stopping gun violence is now the third most important issue for voters after health care and immigration, according to a recent poll. The ongoing epidemic of gun violence prompted Walmart to stop selling handgun ammunition and short barrel rifle ammunition that can also be used on assault-style weapons. Walmart, Kroger, CVS, Wegmans, and other retailers have also requested that customers not openly carry firearms in their stores. These decisions mark a turning point in the effort to protect Americans from gun violence. Senate leaders have instead chosen to continue along the path of cowardice. As the House passage of the background bill and the Walmart and Kroger decisions demonstrate, the firearm industry is losing its stranglehold on our political and legislative institutions, but not fast enough. As long as Mitch McConnell refuses to consider the common sense gun safety pass legislation, it's clear his loyalties lie with the gun lobby and not with the sentiments of the American people who overwhelmingly support background checks and a ban on military-style assault weapons. It's time for the Senate to act. It's time for Mitch McConnell to act. We must do everything we can to urge them to do their job. 202-224-3121 is the number I'd like you to call to speak to your senators and let them know they were elected to defend your safety and your family, not the profits of the gun industry. I'm Mark Morial, and this has been your To Be Equal moment.
We are so excited to finally have the show that we have been planning for what seems like months. We all met just recently at the Congressional Black Caucus Annual Legislative Conference, where A.C. Eggleston Bracey was given an award honoring her lifetime achievements in business. And, of course, we met Orlena months earlier when we were putting together the Crown Coalition. And so bringing the two of you together is a real treat today. And I think our listeners are going to be very excited to hear about this Crown Act initiative that the two of you are really spearheading across the country. But before we get into that, because your life stories are so compelling and so interesting, we thought we'd ask you to spend a little bit of time talking about yourselves and your journey to your current role. And maybe, Kelly, we can start with you. And I'm especially interested in the name of the Joy Collective.
Sure. So I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. Went to school right up the street at Howard University. Best decision my mother ever made for me.
Ain't you?
You know. And started my career at Procter & Gamble. Worked there in brand management, then shifted over to work at BET under Bob Johnson for several years when also we were here in the D.C. office. Left there in 2007, went to Dell to lead global advertising and innovation, and then started my journey as an entrepreneur in 2009. Moved back here to D.C. with my family. Wanted to be back on the East Coast and started my entrepreneurial journey. About 6 years ago, my father passed away and suddenly from a heart attack. And shortly after he passed, a good friend of mine shared that he had commented to her that, you know, Kelly's name is Joy, Kelly Joy. I named her for a reason. And what I don't see is her living in her name and being true to her purpose and her and who she is. As an individual, which is a person full of joy. And I really want to see her create a house of joy and a life of joy. So please promise that you'll help her do that. So right then, after a few weeks after he passed, decided to rebrand the former company as Joy Collective and really live in our purpose, which is about being creating and curating joy for ourselves, for our families, for our communities and the world. And that's really what we're trying to do every day. And so the community being a huge, huge, huge piece of that. And then, of course, Orlena and I have been partners for the past, gosh, out of that 6 years, probably five of the 6 years at least.
Almost six.
And really working very closely on delivering amazing joy for our clients and our families.
So, Orlena, how did you come to be a part of this Joy Collective?
That's a great question. Kelly and I have been friends for many years and actually worked in competitive spaces in the African-American media industry. She was at BET. I was at TV1.
Mm.
But we knew each other personally, and we'd known each other for, it's been, wow, probably 18 years now. And so we were both entrepreneurs, both had our own businesses and doing consulting work in the same space of cultural marketing. And Kelly had recently formed a rebranded Joy Collective, and she said to me, hey, we should be partners. And I looked at her and I said, I'm not really sure what that what that means or what that looks like. Mm-hmm. But the attraction of it being somebody that I love and respect, mm-hmm. and also what she communicated was the purpose.
Right.
And the ethos of Joy and what she intended and what she envisioned was extremely compelling. So it was only actually a few months after she really formed the essence of Joy that I joined. And so we've been doing this dance for, close to 6 years or 6 years now together.
Your organization, the Joy Collective, has done a lot of work to help pass an act called the Crown Act, and it's focused on ending discrimination based on hairstyles and hair types, specifically around African Americans in the workplace. So why do you think it was necessary to pass a law for this? What was going on in that space in California in particular that really said something has to change?
Well, I think that even though we're in 2019 right now, what we did not realize until we really jumped into this work is that it was perfectly legal to discriminate against Black people or any person because of their hair, because of how our hair grows out of our heads. And so the work that we have embarked on with the Crown Act is really helping to clarify the description of race, to incorporate hair in that, such that hair texture and hairstyle should be protected in the Fair Employment and Housing Act. And so that's really what we've been doing, is really making sure that the word, you know, race description is inclusive of hair and how hair comes out of our heads. But one thing I just wanted to mention, as you talked about women and supporting one another,
yes.
Really this work was started by a sister named AC Eggleston Bracey, who leads the personal care division at Unilever. So she oversees a $5 billion enterprise, but she's always, for the past 25 plus years, been focused on communities of color and really was the first person to put Queen Latifah on CoverGirl and multiple other multicultural faces, Zendaya, Rihanna, you name it.
So, Ellen. She put Ellen, you know. So this is about inclusion.
Mm-hmm. So this is really, it started with her. It started with her saying, I really want to make a difference in the community, and then bringing Joy on to help her with that.
So your organization is doing this work, not just on your own, but you're also doing it with a coalition of people. The National Urban League is a part of that coalition and a founding member. We're so proud to be doing that. But I understand you have picked up a lot of steam in terms of getting new members to join the coalition. Can you talk a little bit about how this fire is catching hold in lots of quarters of in corporate America and outside of corporate America?
I think the most important thing to for us to share is that this work is not new, right? What we're doing is providing a platform and resources to bring together all of the voices that for a very long time have fought for racial equity and inclusion in the space of beauty. And ultimately, in the space of beauty, it has impacts socially and economically, right? So this is a much bigger conversation. So what we wanted to ensure is that we are leaning into and giving credit to an opportunity to those now share in this conversation and this new sort of amplified narrative around hair discrimination and the impact that that has on our community. And so we really, that's one of the reasons why it was so important for the original founding members of the Crown Coalition, including the National Urban League, including Green Color of Change, Weston Center on Law and Poverty, and Dove to really include and reach out to all those others that have for a very long time been working hard to make sure that there is equity and inclusion from a cultural perspective in our community, in the African-American community. So we leaned into, we were talking about sisterhood, we leaned into those sisterhood organizations that have a historical commitment to service in our community. And that is, I am not Greek, but Kelly is a Delta, so Delta Sigma Theta, Alpha Kappa Alpha. You have the Lynx Incorporated, you have Jack and Jill of America. It was really important because we're having a conversation about the impact primarily on Black women, that those Black sisterhood organizations are front and center, and that we're hearing those voices, and those voices are leading this narrative. And then we amassed 52 organizations, including our founding members of the Crown Coalition, who have signed on in support of this movement.
And growing every week. So just two more last week. Because people want to be a part of something where they can say, I'm actually making a change and making a difference and impacting my community. So they're seeing us have great success with just the first two states and six or seven more coming very quickly behind, with New Jersey right on our heels. So I think people want to get involved. And so just last week, Emerge came on board, the Black Psychologists, National Action Network, many, many others. So it's been great.
So for a lot of our listeners, this may be totally new information. I mean, if you're on Black Twitter, I don't know how you could avoid this situation, because there are stories replete from all over the United States about real examples of hair discrimination. Can you talk about some real examples that inspired you to get into this movement, and that are the kinds of things that will help people understand what we're talking about when we talk about hair discrimination?
I think Kelly and I both have individual stories. If you speak to most Black women, we have our own personal hair journeys that we can talk about, some confusing, some things celebratory, some painful. But, in terms of why legislation is necessary, right? And we hate that it's necessary in 2019, but one of the inspirations was really the case that went all the way to the Supreme Court, Chastity Jones, who I think she was in Alabama, actually, and she interviewed for a position at a corporation. So this was a white-collar position. She interviewed for a job. She was actually offered the job. And upon receiving that offer, she was told that she would need to cut her dreadlocks in order to accept the position. And when she refused to cut her dreadlocks, and most of us know that dreads take a long time, they're such a part of you, and they really are a characteristic identifier of Blackness. When she refused to cut her locks, they rescinded the job offer. She, in turn, sued, and long story short, through the appellate courts, went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, in May 2018, refused to review the case. In other words, they threw it out, that there was no grounds, not from a federal perspective or constitutional perspective, to read that case. And that's the point Kelly was making earlier, that it really is legal to discriminate based on hairstyle or hair texture that is inherent to race. That's a really, really important piece of it. And so that was the first thing. It was something that our client, the Dove brand, was aware of. And that was one of the things that I think sparked everybody's interest to say, if the Supreme Court can throw this out and we know that this has racial implications, then there's something worth investigating.
Right. And then right after that, there were countless examples in schools as well as the workplace. Mm-hmm. So we have C.J. Stanley, the little six-year-old boy who was sent home on the first day of school. Faith Finity, same thing, suspended because of her braids. And so we saw case after case. And then, of course, Andrew Johnson in December, this past December, the wrestler in New Jersey, who was forced to have his hair cut.
Publicly.
Oh, so it's assault, really.
Very traumatic.
Yeah. Yes. So all of that, we said, something really has to be done. And as Orlina said, Dove had already said, let's do something about it. So that's when the whole journey around the Crown Act really began.
Orlina, I'm a former Senate rat, and I tell you, one of the most exciting things we do as Senate staffers is coming up with cool names for legislation. The Crown Act. Perfect. And it's an acronym, Creating a Respectful and Open World for Natural Hair. Who came up with that?
I wish we could take credit. It's kind of cool, right?
Right.
So actually the inaugural Crown Act came out of California. And all credit due to Senator Holly Mitchell, who is actually from District 30 in Los Angeles. She is a woman, a statuesque woman with natural hair. She wears locks, and she has for a long time. She is the first person to, she's the first state legislator to introduce the Crown Act. There's actually a young lady in her office, Tracy Parker, who came up with the acronym Creating a Respectful and Open Workplace for Natural Hair, and that was the original one. And as we were talking about, you know, what the Crown Act encompasses, both in the workplace, it protects against discrimination both in the workplace and in schools. And so when we really started to expand the Crown Act outside of California and with the Crown Coalition, we decided that it really needed to be beyond the workplace. And so for the Crown Coalition, we say creating a respectful and open world for natural hair. But the original one that Tracy came up with Senator Holly Mitchell, was creating an respectful and open workplace for natural hair, which we think is pretty cool and right on point.
I'm so glad that you mentioned the youth examples of hair discrimination and that you're also working in coalitions with organizations like Jack and Jill and also Black psychologists, because these are very traumatic things for kids, not even if it happens to them, but just to witness it and to see it on TV. It was triggering for me to see the young man have his locks cut off just to compete in a sports event. Does the Crown Act current form in the states where it's passed, does it protect children in school or youth, or is it just for employment and housing?
So it's both. So it's the workplace and schools, K through 12.
Right.
Currently.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons that we have so many supporting organizations. They're organizations that touch the community. They're organizations that are supporting this so that we can create partnership, not only to raise the issue, because one of the biggest challenges we found is most people don't know what hair discrimination, hair bias is. And I'm not talking about the general market. I'm also talking about in our community, which goes to the fact that for hundreds of years in this country, we have been conditioned to think a certain way. And in many cases, it's to think that what is characteristic of the Black race is less than, right? So there is a conditioning, there's a reprogramming that we have to do for ourselves and society at large to reframe this concept that Eurocentric standards of beauty are the only standard. And in doing so, it requires that we're doing education and raising the issue, but we're also enabling and empowering people to take action. So that's understanding what bias and hair discrimination looks like, and then how do you behave? How do you take action if you have experienced that? How do you identify and notice if somebody else is experiencing that? And what are, you know, what's the recourse that you have at that point? So that's a lot of the work that we're going to be doing.
Yeah, and making sure we get it out in the hands of people. So one of our supporters is the Black Beauty and Barbers Association. Okay. So that's a sister out of Cleveland, named Monica Green, who runs that. It's 115,000 beauty salons and barbershops all over the country. So we're working with that organization to get toolkits in all of the beauty salons, because that's where we go time with lacticians or whatever they may be. And so putting that information in those salons that say, this is what the Crown Act is, this is what's protected, this is what's not protected, and then here's who to call if this happens to you. It's already in New York, active in New York. So we're starting in New York and California, and we'll be rolling that across the country as well.
I really love that you're taking it to where the people are, in the barbershops, in the lock care shops, and in the beauty salons, because to many of us, our stylists are like our therapists.
Absolutely.
And people will tell their stylists and their therapists things that maybe they wouldn't tell someone else.
That's right.
The therapist / stylist to be in tune with what discrimination looks like so they can help their clients. That's a beautiful partnership.
Right. So I think important for us is working all angles. So working in the beauty salons and the lock care salons, and then also working with superintendents. We had a good preliminary meeting last week with the American Association of Superintendents.
Wow.
And so that's a huge organization where they make a lot of decisions for their school district. So trying to create a partnership there. And we're really the goal of this, as Arlena said earlier, is to work with people that are already doing work in this space and also with people that can really help us advance the mission of the Crown Coalition.
So the partnership with Dove, the Dove brand, which is owned by Unilever, a multi-billion dollar company, is very interesting to me. Can you describe how that partnership came about?
So AC, who I mentioned earlier, AC Eggleston Bracey, started at Unilever January of 2018. We had known each other because we worked together at Procter & Gamble many 30 years ago. And so she reached out and said, I'd love for Joy Collective to come in and pitch us on potentially working with us. So we went through typical pitch process, just like any agency would, and won the opportunity to work with AC and the entire Dove brand on really engaging women of color in a way that's authentic and that was meaningful and that is meaningful. So that's how it started. I think the reason that Joy and that we're so excited to be working with that particular brand and with that company is that they really are champions for beauty inclusivity and for doing great things in the world. And so it's very much aligned with the purpose of Joy and what we're all about, which is helping to drive positive impact in our community.
Well, so under her leadership and with your firm on board, this is really helping to give the brand a three-way mirror, perhaps, not only for market opportunities, but about how they're talking to their audiences in a way that they didn't always have.
I would say that. We've also, you know, done some future-focused work with some other brands there as well, like Vaseline. And so we're, you know, doing more and more with that organization and really excited to be part of the work that we're doing because we feel like it's so purpose-driven on both sides.
So as a woman of color who has worn my hair natural, has worn it straight, I've had definitely many iterations of extensions in my hair. In the workplace, it's kind of challenging, especially when there's people who don't have your heritage and really don't understand the diversity and variety of Black hair. How do you unpack what is discrimination? Because I'm sure we've all had those comments like, oh, we get a new employee every week. Who's Toni going to be this week? Is she Beyonce? Is she Lupita? Who is she?
We are very versatile,
but you learn to embrace it. That's your culture. And hopefully they're seeing it as a positive as well. But as someone who's worked on this and done this work, can you unpack for us what constitutes hair discrimination mm-hmm. and how do you recognize it? What is and what isn't? So we can be very knowledgeable about that.
No, that's great. And I think what you've really alluded to are two different things. You've alluded to hair bias and microaggressions towards people of color because of their hair. Though that bias and those aggressions can become discrimination in a certain form when you are prevented from having a particular job opportunity or prevented from education that you should have a right to. That's when it becomes discrimination. And the Crown Act specifically protects against hair discrimination that is an act of discrimination, racially based or race-based discrimination based on natural hair. So what's actually written, for example, in Senate Bill 188, which was the bill that became law in California, is that it's really those characteristics of hair that are inherent to Black identity. So it expands the definition of race to include hair texture or hairstyles that are connected to race. And so that may be dreadlocks, and they're actually named in the bill. So if you were, and anybody, you know, it's public domain. So whether it's New York or California or New Jersey or any other state where these bills have been introduced, you can actually look that up and you'll see they'll name dreadlocks, they'll name braids, in some cases name Bantu knots. So those hairstyles that are very much indicative of race. And I've heard people ask about color, you know, or other styles. Those things start to get into a very, very subjective space. But if we can show through history that there is a racial connection, I'm not a lawyer, but we have been very well educated by the lawyers and the legislators behind this so that we understand that it's very much an expansion of the definition of race. So it's those hairstyles that are traditionally associated with race.
Mm. One other thing, when you talk about history, that's so important when you talk about Black hair, because we know that some people still remember the 60s and 70s, and black hair was a political statement. To wear your hair in all its forms, we came out of the 30s and 40s where we definitely had those movements, and they meant something to our community. They were a part of our identity. It was almost like a political defiance to wear your hair and not to conform to what was considered culturally acceptable in America. How does this correlate to what we're starting to see about a resurgence of discrimination based on hair texture and hairstyle amongst African Americans?
To be honest with you, I don't think it's a resurgence. I think that we're in a time where we have more line of sight and visibility to those microaggressions and to the discrimination that we've always faced, mm-hmm. right? I think we live in an age of technology that gives us more visibility through social media and other things in the way that those microaggressions manifest themselves. So we're just seeing it more, mm-hmm. right? And I, you know, hate to say there are other things, whether it's police brutality or anything, that we've seen through history. And you brought up history. History is so important because we're having this conversation about hair discrimination in 2019 because history has conditioned us. As black people, all people, as American people, history has conditioned us to think a certain way and to think that Eurocentric standards of beauty are the standard of beauty. So anything that's not that is less than. So when you talk about, you know, a show of defiance, I think now when you look at younger generations and you really study sort of the millennials and the Gen Z and you see this natural hair movement, I think it may be subconscious, you know, defiance maybe, but I also think that as we have more exposure through social media, we're seeing more across the world. We have a more global point of view. I mean, I think about, I'm a Nigerian immigrant, right? British and Nigerian immigrant. I have an opportunity today to engage and talk to my family and my cousins and my friends in Nigeria more so than I ever did. I can do that daily through social media. So I think we're seeing more that's encouraging us to celebrate. So I think it's less about defiance and a statement. And I think it's more about really being true to who we are, where we came from, and celebrating that in a way that we haven't had an opportunity mm-hmm. to celebrate before. I think it's also because we have more information, right? So I'll be honest, we could be here all day if I talked about my hair journey across three continents and what it was to be a little girl growing up in Nigeria where my hair was, I'm mixed, right? So when my hair was, and for some people here in this country, they call it biracial. You know, my hair was too soft to be braided or plaited. My cornrows didn't last as long. So I went from that and then coming to the United States as a teenager and finding out, you know, that I'm black and my hair is, you know, I didn't really know how to treat my hair in this country. And I thought I needed to conform in the 80s and 90s to look like what I saw in the magazines and what my, you know, classmates look like. So I think we're finally coming full circle, right, from all of us trying to adhere to those standards and putting toxic chemicals in our hair and then learning that that toxicity has done incredible damage to not just our hair, but to our person. And now we're learning we don't have to do that. And I think we're supporting each other in a way that allows us to celebrate. So I like to believe it's less defiant and more celebration and acknowledgement of what really is beautiful about the way that we are made just as is.
Sounds like you missed the whole hot comb era. Is that right?
Okay, so we had it in Nigeria just like you had it here, the comb on the stove, ooh, yes. Right? And it's funny because I was in, you talk about beauticians and your stylist. I've had the same stylist for 10 years. She really is my therapist as well. And I remember sitting in there, and it's the salon a week or two ago, and there are a lot of Caribbean stylists in there and all kinds of different folks. And I saw, you know, I don't know what you call it, but nowadays it is the version of the stove, but it's a little thing that heats up the hot comb, mm-hmm. right at the stylist station. And I was looking at that and I had to giggle because I remember right on the gas, right? In Nigeria might be on the kerosene, like little kerosene lantern thing. So we've all been through a history of that. But think about the modern version of that hot comb when we were all in our 20s. You know, I'm late 40s now, but when we were in our 20s and we were doing it ourselves and we were buying the hottest curling iron you could get, yeah. And then you got those buns on the back of your neck, the kitchen. You got the buns on your ears and your forehead. So we have subjected ourselves to so much to try to conform. And try to conform because we've been told for so many years that we have to conform to be acceptable, right? And acceptable doesn't mean on par necessarily in this country. And we can look at the statistics in general, whether it's pay equity or anything else. So I think we're just one, we're tired. We're tired, right? I think we're also finally turning inward to ourselves as a community, supporting each other, having access to each other across the diaspora, and really beginning to appreciate what our roots mean and what they represent, even as it is the hair that grows out of our head.
So if our listeners want to learn more about how we can support the Crown Act legislation, it sounds like you folks are doing it the old-fashioned way, mm-hmm. state by state, maybe even city by city, census tract by census tract. You're certainly doing
barbershop
it.
Barbershop by barbershop.
Yeah. That's right.
How can our listeners and folks in the greater Urban League movement keep up with what you're doing and support your efforts?
So there are two things in particular that we ask and encourage people to do. One is to visit thecrownact.com. There is a petition that to this day we have, I think, almost 45,000 or just over 45,000 signatures. That's significant. Usually you'll see 8,000 to 10,000, 15,000 signatures for a particular issue. We are determined to reach 100,000 signatures. That, I think, will demonstrate nationwide that there is a real urgency around this issue. So we are asking people to sign the petition at thecrownact.com.
Movement, did you hear that? All right.
Thank you. The second thing is that we are not only interested in advancing legislation at a state level, because we do know schools, education, and workplace are regulated at a state level, but federal legislation mm-hmm. is really important as well, which is why we need to raise the issue as much as possible. We need to encourage our elected officials to identify this and introduce legislation. And so we are asking folks to contact, right? I would say harass, but please contact gracefully your state legislators or even your federal representatives, and you let them know that this is an issue for the community. This is an issue for society at large. And we had an interesting conversation yesterday with the lead sponsors of the New Jersey Crown Act. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, you know, your representatives will listen to you. And it is part of our responsibility as citizens to let them know what the issues are. Right. That are important to us. So we need to continue to encourage people to contact their representatives. The other thing is make some noise.
Yeah.
Right? So social media is one of the most beautiful, sometimes dangerous, but one of the most beautiful platforms that we have. Technology is a good thing in that regard. And so we're asking people to spread the word amongst your friends, your networks, your communities. Let's make sure that this is part of a continuous part of the public discourse and conversation so that our representatives do know it's an issue and we continue to fight for laws that protect us.
I know when I'm trying to find out more information about the latest and the greatest, at least on Twitter, I go to hashtag the Crown Act. Are there any other hashtags or any other user groups, any social media?
You can definitely follow us because we are all over the place with the Crown Act because we are going to make sure that this this reaches every corner of the earth. But, you know, hair discrimination is a hashtag, hashtag hair discrimination. It's not the most positive spin, but it's the necessary spin because that's exactly what we're dealing with. So hashtag hair discrimination, hashtag the Crown Act are the two that we ask people to follow. That's where we're really focusing the public conversation. But we've seen folks create their own. We've seen so many others.
It's a movement.
It really is.
I just want to also piggyback on the crownact.com. People can find their local legislators there. So after you sign the petition, there's a click through at the bottom that you can put in a link that you can find exactly who your local legislators are at the state level, and that's who you want to send information to. And then if you live in New Jersey, because we're right now working really hard to pass the Crown Act in the state of New Jersey, as we heard yesterday from Senator Sandra Cunningham, Angela McKnight, those two fantastic women shared the importance of writing to the governor of New Jersey. So if you live in New Jersey, reach out to the governor and say, we really need you to sign this Crown Act and make this a law.
Well, my day job is dealing with public officials and elected officials in Washington and elsewhere, so challenge accepted. We're going to start trying to use our infrastructure here in the National Urban League to get the ball moving.
That's awesome.
In New Jersey. We've got a really strong affiliate presence in New Jersey.
Absolutely.
And very politically active as well.
Right. And what we will do and what we promised the legislators yesterday is that we'll get the word out when we have a hearing date. So it will be in the Senate side in the Judiciary Committee, and then in the Labor Committee on the Assembly side of the state of New Jersey. And they said, the more the merrier. We want people to sign up and come testify.
Oh, wow.
So we will make sure that you, as one of our founding members, have all that information. Please share that with your networks so that people can show up.
So your audience knows, that's a vote. That's when those state legislators that are not the sponsors of the bill get to vote whether they think that that is a worthy issue in their state. So it's really important for us to ensure that they are in support of the Crown Act.
Now, if we want to get hold of those toolkits that help us identify hair discrimination, would that also be found on thecrownact.com?
It will be.
Okay, great.
And you can reach out to us as well.
Sounds great.
Thank you.
Wow, it's been a joy, actually, to have you here.
Thank you.
We appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah.
In our affiliate spotlight, we would like to recognize the outstanding work of the Urban League of Greater Kansas City, Missouri, under the leadership of its president and CEO, Ms. Gwendolyn Grant. Earlier this year, the affiliate published a comprehensive State of Black Kansas City report focused on urban education, economics, health, social justice, and civic engagement. The report, which made national news, used data and community insights to thoroughly examine and assess the quality of life for Black residents in these key areas through the lens of equity. Congratulations on creating a solutions-driven report that not only asks, where do we go from here, but provides a roadmap to the destination. To learn more about the Urban League of Greater Kansas City, follow them on Twitter at Urban League GKC and visit their website at www.ulkc.org. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at NUL Policy for updates. Be sure to rate us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Google Play. Kudos to our production team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to For the Movement, presented by the National Urban League.